Blog Talk Radio.
Life is a song worth singing.
I do too.
Sing it. Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you sing it?
You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it?
Welcome, welcome to another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And today's date is November the 20th, 2019. And I'm your host, Ronald Bethay. And we have a very, very exciting show scheduled for you today. We are hoping that we'll be joined by Commissioner Obi Linton, Esquire Commissioner, with the Public Service Commission. He's scheduled to be with us this morning, and I hope he'll be joining and calling in very, very shortly. But until then, we're going to always do what we do. You know, those who join us on a regular basis, you know that Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, serves as an economic blueprint for self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, as well. Large or small, along with increasing market share for African-American solar installation companies to address the effects of high energy costs that are historically Black colleges and universities, also to utilize Black-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects to bring down the unemployment and underemployment of young African Americans locally and nationally, also to educate the Black community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education in the Black community through Black Talk radio programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. It's also brought to you by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSLS HBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative, which you're listening to at the present time over the platform of Blog Talk Radio. We're streaming over Facebook, Twitter, and Link Live, so you'll be able to listen in on your smartphones and Android devices. As well as, it's brought to you every week by Scotton Communications Network, specializing in the following areas: public relations, writing, editing, web development, web editing, magazine production, online and traditional, newspaper production, online and traditional, speech writing, book writing, editing and publishing, and speaker bureau management. And for contact information, you can contact scottoncommunicationsnetwork.com. That's S-C-O-T-T-O-N, communicationsnetwork.com. And welcome, welcome, welcome. Now that we've been able to pay a few bills here, that keeps us on this platform, and you know those who join us, you know the slogan for the show. If it's power in numbers, then the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. Now, many of you who join us on a regular basis, you know that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 646-668-2948. And please remember to press 1 on your phone pad after dialing the call-in number. And as I indicated, we're scheduled to be joined by Mr. Adil Abby Linton, Esquire. He is a commissioner with the Public Service Commission for the state of Maryland. We're going to just sort of get our guest introduced to you, even though he has not joined us as yet. I want to give you a little background information on Mr. Linton and where he hails from and a little bit about his educational background, which we have posted on our website. You can join us by logging on to our website at positivechangepc.com. That's Positive Change, P as in Paul, City, C as in cat.com. And you'll be able to follow us by just strolling over to our news and events tab and strolling down. Commissioner Linton was appointed to the Maryland Public Service Commission in August of 2017 after serving for almost 9 years as the Commissioner's Director of External Relations and Retail Market Development. In that capacity, he managed consumer relations and dispute resolutions and led the Commission's effort in creating a regulation for consumer protection and theft of energy, consumer education, and consumer choice and supply diversity. He has served the Commission in an advisory capacity of the utility consumer and deregulated market matters and in the founding of the chair of the Utility Marketplace Access, now a supplier and workforce diversity. Staff Subcommittee for the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners, NARUC, and has served as a member of the Staff Commission Consumer Affairs for 7 years. He began his career in 1991 as a member as a meter reader and an engineer intern with the Public Service Electric and Gas in New Jersey. Commissioner Linton first came to Maryland's Public Service Commission as a law intern and was later clerk for the Honorable Elaine Omega Cannon in the Circuit Court of Baltimore City. Commissioner Linton worked as a regulatory attorney at Baltimore Gas and Electric Company, where he worked on the regulation of the electric industry and specialized in consumer disputes. Over the 5 years later, he rejoined the commission as the Deputy Chief Counsel, where he was assigned the additional responsibility of leading the commission's consumer dispute resolution unit. The Commissioner Linton then left the commission to start his own law firm. He represented consumer small businesses and deregulated suppliers in litigation and transactional matters. He eventually closed his firm and returned to the commission to serve as the director of the Office of External Relations, where he also handles retail market development and supply diversity matters. Along his multiple responsibility, Commissioner Linton led a multi-year effort to adopt new consumer protections to deregulate markets and enhance notice requirements for meter tampering. Commissioner Linton holds a Bachelor of Science in Administration of Justice and a Bachelor's of Arts in African Studies from Rutgers University and a Juris Doctorate from the University of Maryland Law. He is admitted to the Maryland Bar and is a resident of Cadenceville, Maryland. Now, we are hoping that we'll be joined by Commissioner Linton a little more, but I just wanted to go ahead and give you a little of his background because this gentleman had a very, very extensive background, and we wanted to make sure that we would be able to get that information to our listening audience. We are getting a call in from Commissioner Linton. still here on the airways. And let me make sure I'm back in here.
Hello?
Well, welcome, Commissioner Linton.
Hello?
Good morning, Commissioner Linton. I apologize. When you called in on my phone number, I had to go off air long enough to reconnect to our show because we broadcast through our phone here in our studio. So I apologize for that glitch, but I have you here now on the airways of Solar Now in the Future with this economic impact on Black America, and I want to welcome you once again to our show.
Thank you very much, and good morning to all of you listeners out there.
Well, sir, we're very, very, very pleased to have you. I'm just going to go back Commissioner Linton. Now, I don't like to change the take away the responsibility that the parents have blessed you with your first name, brother, but I was struggling with it. Would you please pronounce your first name for our listening audience?
Absolutely. It's Odogwu. Odogwu
Obi-Wan
is my name.
Okay, great. Now, I'm assuming that you're from the one of our African nations.
I was born here, but my father's side of the family is from Nigeria.
That's what I was thinking. So I wanted to make sure that our listening audience had it, but. You were appointed to the Public Service Commission in 2017 after serving for almost 9 years as the Commission's Director of External Relations and in the Retail Market Development. So I'm just going to touch upon some of the things you've done. You've also served at the Commission in an advisory capacity for the Utility Consumer and Deregulated Market Matters, and in founding the chair of the Utility Marketplace Access, now the Supplier and Workforce Diversity Staff Subcommittee for the National Association for Regulatory Utility Commissioners, NARUC, and has served as a member of the Staff Consumer Force Committee for 7 years, which I read that little information to our listening audience right before you call in and join us. But one of the things that I was looking at when I had an opportunity to basically look at some of the different things that you have done. You have a very, very, very diverse background, and we wanted to share with our listening audience, as in your capacity with the Public Service Commission, they have a supplier diversity program. Could you talk a little about that program? Because this public supplier diversity program, it is aimed at providing women, minorities, and service-disabled veterans, businesses, and nonprofit organizations great opportunities to participate in business and compete for contracts and subcontracts with the public utilities. And participating companies have signed a memorandum of understanding with the commission that outlined the goal to award 25% of their total dollars spent with subcontractors and purchase orders. And I think that memorandum of understanding to diverse suppliers is a win-win situation. Could you sort of talk about this program, sir, because I know that you've had quite a bit of experience with that.
Absolutely, sure, and happy to do so. The program itself is referenced at the commission under the name of Public Conference 16. It actually started almost 25 years ago, and it was founded by, at the time, through some proposed legislative action in our General Assembly. The action didn't go through, but you may recognize, I'm sure you'll recognize, the names of the two individuals that worked on it at the time. One of them was a delegate here in Maryland named Pete Rawlings. His daughter went on to be a mayor here in Baltimore several years ago. And the other was our very own Elijah Cummings. They worked on it over 25 years ago. And the idea was to encourage our utility companies to commit to spend upwards of 25% of a total company-wide spend with diverse-owned firms. And that was now almost 27 years ago. It got revitalized back around 2008 when I came to the commission. At the time, another commissioner named Harold Williams, who was there before me, spearheaded the effort to get the commission to recommit and encourage the utility companies to recommit to the idea. They did so. More companies came on board. I began to work on it as well with the full commission and all of the utility companies. I served in a liaison capacity to make sure that the utilities on a day-to-day basis were doing everything they could to find and help develop diverse-owned firms, women-owned firms, and disabled veteran-owned firms, so that if they weren't prepared to work with utility companies, they could learn how to. The main goal was to make sure that the program, that the products and the services that utility companies access through third-party companies, that those contracts, those opportunities were available to everybody. The whole point is that we wanted to make sure the utilities were allowing everybody to compete for those opportunities. And through that competition, all customers got the best price from the utility because the competition would drive down the cost of the product or the service. Today, I'm happy to report that multiple other states across the country have looked at Maryland's voluntary model. And the reason why is because it makes good business sense. We didn't have to pass a law to force the utility companies to do these things. Because when they looked at the ledger, they looked at what's happening in overall society where we're becoming more diverse. They looked at the multiple retirements that utility companies are having with seniors and older employees that are leaving and the challenges they're having in bringing in younger people. And they looked at the constant growing needs to continue to provide top service to all customers in the form of improved grid reliability, renewable energy solutions like net metering and solar, community solar, all of these new ideas that we're looking to develop and grow and use our grid in ways that's never been used before. And they needed to pursue new innovation, and they needed to incorporate everybody. All of us are a part of this growth. And so this the Supplier Diversity Initiative was really just a way to encourage that, to embrace it, and it was forward-looking. Even 25 years ago to today, where now we see multiple other states looking at what Maryland has done and are trying to do the same thing.
Well, I'm glad to hear that Maryland has a progressive program But one of the things that's been troubling to me, you know, I had the privilege of meeting you at the Maryland Clean Energy Summit, which was held at the University of Maryland a couple of weeks ago. And at that time, I had the privilege of meeting Mr. James Rakowski, who is the Assistant Secretary of the Department of Labor. And I recently had a telephone conversation with him, and he indicated that the state of Maryland has a $110 million state budget for workforce development for the entire state, which includes 24 counties, for 2020. And he indicated that 80% of that money comes from the federal government for the 24 counties in the state. Now, when I began to look at it, then in preparing this show today, I began to think, well, what role does the Maryland Public Service Commission in determining the following? How will this money be spent? When will it be spent? And where will it be spent? And how does this impact on the role that the Public Service Commission plays in making the decision? So could you elaborate a little on what role the Public Service Commission plays when the workforce development programs are developed? Because y'all are a statewide commission, so I would assume that y'all would have an impact and a say for all 24 counties in the state. Am I correct on that?
For purposes of utility regulation, yes. So the commission wouldn't direct the allocation of money set aside for workforce development. Now, but what the commission does do in regulating utility companies is we encourage, we work with, and we help to help our utility companies pursue projects, expansion, pipeline replacement, grid hardening, which means that they're putting up stronger poles and wires in order to, or in some cases, placing cables underground so that when a storm comes by, the power doesn't go off as easily. We encourage our utility companies to continue pursuing those initiatives. Those initiatives require staffing, employees, third-party companies. So in some cases, the goals of the utility company and the goals of the state government for purposes of workforce development are aligned. You know, the state might also need people to do paving work, for example, and so for highway development. And so the state will work to make sure that there's additional employees there. And those same skills that the utility companies need for their work are the same skills that the state may need for other projects. So there's opportunities there for one person who's trained in one area to do the same work in another area. The second thing the commission does is we work with our utilities at times when the utility companies have, for example, recently Washington Gas was merged with or was purchased by another utility called AltaGas, which is a company that has several subsidiaries across the United States and in Canada. And as part of that merger, there were conditions placed on that merger by the commission. One of the conditions was one that Washington Gas most recently announced, I guess about a month ago, where it's called Focus 25, where they are now encouraging and developing new companies to, they're bringing them in-house and teaching them how to work in the utility industry. And in doing that, those companies are going to become bigger, they're going to develop more employees and more staff, and they're going to be relying on some of the same people that are working with the state government's initiatives for workforce development. So basically, the reason I'm going through those different directions is that while the commission is not influencing or spending the money or allocating the money that you mentioned earlier with the Workforce Commission, what the Public Service Commission does in the regulation of utility companies is we're also engaged in the workforce development mode by encouraging our utility companies to embrace as many different initiatives as possible to keep a robust workforce on staff and able to respond to challenges should they arise. Storm outages, replacing gas pipelines, all kinds of new grid hardening solutions, tree trimming, vegetation management, all of these kinds of initiatives all the utility companies are engaged in. So it is a statewide initiative that works in a parallel with the state government initiative.
Well, we both know that climate change is a very, very real issue, which is driving a lot of issues in the state of Maryland. Matter of fact, I think it was, well, I met with Senator Cardin's office concerning some of these same issues, but what's been very, very disturbing to me, Commissioner Linton, is that there is a large lack of diversity in the renewable energy industry. And when you identify and look at the Maryland being a member of the PJM region, and as in this PJM region, we are a deregulated market. And I know that you worked on a lot of that regulation. Could you sort of explain to our listening audience the important role that the Maryland Public Service Commission has played in the wholesale markets and in getting some of the legislation and dealing with the issue of deregulation versus regulated markets? And could you explain to our listening audience the advantages that we have by living in a deregulated market versus a regulated market?
Sure, and I'll try and keep it brief. I mean, this is a 20-year-plus topic that's been going on for a long time. So the Maryland's market, and we're one of 26 states that have done this, by deregulating, we now no longer have utility companies that are the wording is vertically integrated, which basically means that the utility company owns the transmission, the distribution, and the generation. Now, the utility companies that you see that send you your bill every day, call if there's a problem with your lights in your home or if you smell gas in your home, that utility company still handles the distribution of energy to your house. Those large transmission lines that you see when you drive along the highway, you know, and they're hundreds of feet in the air and there's no trees growing on them or anything. Those transmission lines, that whole industry was deregulated along with the generation of energy. The reason why that was important a while ago is that we realized that there are different companies that generate energy in a different manner. And those different companies, some of them are able to generate energy and they can do it at a cheaper price than others can. So the idea was that we could allow those companies to compete with each other and the utility company would be able to buy the energy at the cheapest rate and that would lower prices for all customers. So these are companies that are enormous. You know, they are some of the largest companies in the country, billion-dollar corporations. And they want to sell different types of energy. Some of them generate their electricity through using coal, some through nuclear power, some through natural gas, a lot more through natural gas recently. And over the more recent period of time, more and more companies are now investing in solar energy or in wind energy online and more recently as well offshore wind. So what the deregulated market does is allows not only the large utility companies to buy a mix of fuels, and it allows the local governments and the state government to determine what type of fuel would be used in our state. But it also gives the opportunity for individual consumers, large corporations, and residential citizens like you and I, the ability to buy our fuel directly from a particular company that generates the kind of energy we'd like to use. So if you want solar energy or if you want wind energy, you may pay a little more for it at this time, but you can pay for that directly and use that type of energy over something else for whatever reason you prefer. If, however, you don't really mind using something that's not considered a renewable energy, such as coal, or you can go and buy energy that way. So the deregulated market, by allowing more people to have more engagement, has opened up a lot of other opportunities. We now have new businesses that are coming into Maryland that are engaged in Maryland and are more interested in investing here as well. So you have large companies that are interested in offering solar-related solutions, rooftop solar for people who have, would like the solar panels in their home, for example. We have more companies that are willing to offer larger-scale utility solar initiatives. And the state of Maryland has had a lot more flexibility in determining the overall state's goals for the consumption of energy used in our state. And our General Assembly recently did that through the passage of the Clean Energy Jobs Act here in Maryland, which it required that the state would use 50% renewable energy by 2030.
Well, could you please tell me what was the carve-out for solar and wind in that new bill? Because I think it was around 2% prior to that, but
yes.
I don't hold me to that. But I know that in the new regulations, and one thing that's very, very concerning to me, which you sort of opened the door on that by discussing the Renewable Portfolio Standard 50% legislation that was passed in Annapolis last year, is that the burning of trash accelerators was considered as a clean renewable energy. And I just had such a problem with that because our community suffered disproportionately by the impacts of these burning incinerators in our communities. We have a higher asthma rates in our African American communities. We have cancer, and I can go on and on talking about this, and this is documented by the NAACP Environmental Justice Group, and they have put out a report that says nationally within 70-mile radius of any African-American community, you will have one of these type of incendiary plants. So what has been the position of the Maryland State Public Commission on this issue about the incinerators and how they're impacting on the environment in Maryland?
Well, there's a couple of topics in there. So first, the carve-out for offshore wind through the Clean Energy Jobs Act was raised to 1,200 megawatts through the Clean Energy Jobs Act. And for solar, the carve-out was 14.5%, again, by 2030. And that's a very aggressive number.
No question. That's a very aggressive number.
Very aggressive. So it's going to be interesting to see how we move forward with that. Now, with regard to trash incinerators, and the locations of those. The Public Service Commission, we really can't take a position publicly on it because we have the responsibility to hear from
everybody
and the various state agencies that will determine or will propose to us where a incinerator should be placed, the size of it, what types of conditions should be placed on it. Since I've been on the commission, we haven't had any of them that have been proposed to us that we've had a chance to look at. In the past, I know the commission has located them in some areas where there's been some concern, and it has been documented concern that it has an impact, especially on low-income communities. So I can tell you that it's something that I'll pay a very close attention to should we have another that's presented to us. But that CPCN process is always starts anew when it's presented to the commission. So we can't take a publicly stated position on where we think they should be. But
okay,
because the commission,
that's very understandable.
Yeah, but the commission is a part of the, it's called the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, or CPCN for short. And those are filed fairly consistently with us. But I would encourage you and your listeners to pay close attention and to watch closely what happens in front of our State General Assembly this particular session. There's been several, and you know, I'm not saying anything that's not in the public domain already. There's several elected officials and others who have talked about the need to make some changes to our to how we generate our energy and to the RPS goals we have, to the types of fuel we count as quote unquote clean fuel, such as the process called black liquor, which is a offshoot of the process that's used to produce paper. A large corporation that used to produce a lot of it is no longer in business out in Western Maryland. So there's been some talk about should that still be characterized or classified as a renewable fuel. So these topics are all going to come up during this upcoming session. And it's going to be a lively one, I think, for renewable energy issues. And so I'd encourage you to pay attention to what gets proposed and to talk about
Commissioner Linton, I'm very, very concerned because most of our people pay little or pay no attention about energy. Most of them don't realize how important role that the Public Service Commission plays locally and nationally in determining how renewable portfolio standard legislation is implemented in the state. Now, Maryland is a very unique state because back in 2011, the former provost of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, Dr. Thompson, she in fact had a 17-acre solar farm built in 2011, which was the first solar farm built on a historically black college or university's campus of any significance in 2011. It was a 17-acre farm. And I went down in 2015 and met with Dr. Dunn, head of the School of Engineering. And he took me in his office, and this is 2015. He linked up to the satellite, and he beamed down, and he showed me 100,000 acres of large-scale solar power plants that have been built on the eastern shore of Maryland surrounding UMES's campus. As far as the eye can see, there are wind farms and solar farms, but the impact that it had on the Estrax markets or the energy credits, it sort of crashed the market in Maryland because those farmers were studying the model at UMES. When they got wind that NASA was curtailing their commercial launches at Cape Canaveral in Florida, and they moved that launch facility to Aikiki Island off the eastern shore of Maryland, this thing really blew up in terms of the large expansion of wind farms and solar farms on the eastern shore, and a lot of this energy is being sold back to NASA, I understand. But could you tell me the role that the Public Service Commission played in the development of these large-scale power plants on the eastern shore?
Sure. The plants that you're talking about, it's called a utility-scale solar. So they're large above 2 megawatt-hour generators of solar energy. And for those types of plants, it goes through the same process that I described earlier. So they call the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity. So the commission would make sure that all of the state agencies that review everything from the impact to the environment to the concerns that the citizens in the area would have about the view of the power plant and the any emissions it might have or jobs that it'll create, any of those other issues. All of those issues are presented to the commission, and we're the ones that would give the authority to the corporation that would like to build the power plant to go forward with it. The local government, or in this case the county on the shore where these power plants are built, and it's the same for all of the counties across the state of Maryland, they would also have some zoning authority to make sure that local ordinances are met and are followed so that the plant is in line with the local laws in the region. So the commission is responsible primarily for making sure that more on a state level, those rules and laws are met. Now, chances are these types of initiatives were approved because of a process called net metering, which was passed by the General Assembly, I'm trying to guess right, around 10 years ago, give or take. It's been updated a couple of times since then. But the general idea is that people can sell their generation. This is small generation, but they'll be able to sell the generation that they make through these solar panels and make it available to the utility company. And they'll be able to sell it through the utility company sell it to the utility company. And by doing that, they make a profit off of it. That process is in statute. It's part of the state's effort to try and raise more involvement on the solar markets.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because one of the things that came out, I attended a workshop on commercial PACE and residential PACE that was put on by the PACE organization. For our listening audience, that's the Property Assessment Clean Energy Program, which Congress has passed legislation that looks at renewable energy upgrades the same way as public water and sewer. And it has spawned billions of dollars in private investment in renewable energy, but little or no money is being put by the private sector in the residential PACE. And has this been any kind of discussion held by your commission concerning this issue of, if you want to do commercial PACE in say Baltimore City with projects, that those same companies should or investors should be sort of put in a position where there should be investment in residential PACE, which will give that homeowner, and specifically in communities, low and moderate income communities of color, an opportunity where they can. It's not based on the credit score. It's not based in the equity in the property. It's based on the tax value of that property, where someone could borrow up to about 20% to put a new roof on the property or put a solar PV system on one's roof. So has there been any discussion with the Public Service Commission around this issue of commercial versus residential PACE in the state of Maryland come through the Public Service Commission?
Not directly, no. But I would suggest that it will probably be an issue that we'll have to discuss in the near future because of the state's new, more aggressive RPS goals. And we're not going to get it by just placing large utility scale solar on farmland. There's going to have to be more of an initiative, I think, to work with in urban environments, in low-income communities, and that's part of the state as well. So I suspect more of that will come up in the near future, but it has not happened up until this point.
Well, another question, Commissioner Lynn, because I got a bunch of them for you, and I know 30 minutes goes by fast, but
that's all right.
How is the state of Maryland and the city of Baltimore specifically dealing with this issue of electric vehicle range anxiety by putting charging station infrastructure in the state? Because this is a major, major issue in the state of Maryland concerning this electric vehicle infrastructure. And has there been any bills or any hearings around these issues held at the Public Service Commission there?
Yes, there's quite a few initiatives in Maryland to encourage or to address the question of range anxiety for electric vehicles. There are several grant programs for those customers who are interested in buying an electric vehicle. The Maryland Energy Administration is offering some of those programs. You can go right on their website at I think it's mea.gov, and you can learn more about what their initiatives are, those initiatives that are available there. The Public Service Commission, as part of our Grid of the Future initiative, we also authorize our local utility company in the urban areas. It's mostly Baltimore Gas and Electric Company and Potomac Edison Electric, although the other IOU companies, First Energy and Delmarva Power, have initiatives as well. All of them are offering some rebate programs for customers that are interested in having an electric charger on their home. And it's a rebate of about $300 to have the charging station on your property. And utility companies are taking applications for those. We expect them to go fairly fast. So if people are interested, they should apply for it right away once the utilities open up the application process. We're working also. There are going to be some charging stations made available on government-owned property throughout the state. And each local jurisdiction, the counties and Baltimore City, are talking to their respective utility company representatives so that they can request a certain number of charging stations on locations within their region. So I can tell you, if you ever look at a map of Baltimore City and you look at and you try and find how many gas stations, and again, I'm using Baltimore City as an example of an urban area, you look to see how many gas stations are in the city, you know, the number is fairly small, especially when you get to the downtown region. But if you look in that same map or a similar map of that area and you look for electric charging stations, there are quite a few of them. And so some of them are private owned. Some of them are, you know, owned by different charging companies that are out there. But the utility companies will be offering a few of those as well. And they'll be located in the city. I don't know the locations yet. They haven't been announced in Baltimore. But I do know that the city is engaged with BGE. The local governments of Prince George's County, Montgomery County, are also engaged with Potomac PEPCO, and local jurisdictions in other parts of the state are doing the same thing. In addition, there's going to be there'll be efforts to locate charging stations on multi-unit dwellings or apartment complexes, so that there'll be specific spots on the property where you can have a charging station or a charger right there, even in apartment complexes, so people with electric vehicles can charge there. So the commission had a proceeding on this several months ago and issued an order to encourage all of these initiatives to go forward. And we had a number of companies appear before us to encourage us to proceed, including companies that would be competitors of the utility company. So we're talking about companies like ChargePoint, people who are already investing in a charging infrastructure and a charging network. And they were encouraging us and asking that we would allow utility companies to also own charging to address the very issue that we're talking about, issue of range anxiety. The commission is committed to addressing this issue. The state of Maryland is still committed to having 300,000 electric vehicles on our roads by 2025. We do know that within the next 3 years, there are going to be over 100 new vehicles, electric vehicles that will be available for purchase by consumers. So this is a exciting time. We're at the forefront of it right now. So I hope that your listeners are staying engaged and will be involved in it once it starts moving along further.
Well, Commissioner Linton, people don't realize the important roles that our Public Service Commission plays and impacts on their everyday lives. For example, I had the privilege of having the former head of the Public Service Commission in Washington, D.C., the chair, Mrs. Betty Ann Kane, to be a guest on our show back in 2000. 17. And yeah. At that time, the District of Columbia had a 50% renewable portfolio law, and they had a 5% carve out for solar energy. But I don't have to tell you about the issue of space in the District of Columbia and the issue of density. And because there was a shortfall of DC-based solar, because the way that the city council crafted the law was they allowed a Pepco, which is the major utility provider in the district, to purchase these energy credits for hydrogenetics from energy generators outside, physically outside of the District of Columbia, for wind outside of the District of Columbia. But for solar energy, it had to come from the physical landmass of D.C. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand, unless you go into the district of government, and I actually got these actual numbers from an official with Pepco, they had done an analysis and they had looked at the issue of rooftop repair in the city in wards 8, 5, 6, and 7. And the young lady who was doing the analysis for Pepco, she said, look, we can keep this real. Unless Mayor Bowser is willing to spend between $50 to $80 million to assist baby boomers who are our older customers who are homeowners in these wards, repair these rooftops, we can never abate this compliance fee, because sure, we wrote the check, and in 2016, Betty Ann Cain, the former chair, she was on my show in 17. She indicated that D.C. residents paid $15 million extra for energy because of the shortfall of D.C.-based solar. And in 2017, that number jumped up to $26.6 million. And she said, look, these compliance fees, Pepco says, look, we've got farms that we have already developed that we can buy this energy from and would not even have to pass these fees. They're called compliance fees in the district, onto our ratepayers, because we are a business. And I was talking to Miss Donna Cooper, who was the president, very dynamic sister to the president of Pepco in the district. She said, look, we don't take any joy in having to pass these compliance fees onto our ratepayers when we could have purchased these credits from generators outside, energy generators outside of the district, and not passed them on. But because this was done this way, the residents or the people who can afford PV systems took a major, major push with all those who have a vested interest in seeing D.C. have the highest SRAX values in outside of the state of California in D.C., whereas you went to cross the line in the state of Maryland, as I was talking about the large-scale buildup of the large-scale power plants on Eastern Shore had sort of crashed the market in Maryland, where at that time the credits were trading for somewhere between $6 to $10 in the state of Maryland. It was trading over $300 in the district. So when you get this different type of disparity in the value of these ratepayers and the way that the grid systems are made, set up where you have lines that lead into the District of Columbia, I found out Maryland residents who live right on the line where they have these feeder lines leading back into the district could actually take advantage of the DC SRAX market Did the Public Service Commission play any role in helping to craft out that type of carve out?
Well, not in the District of Columbia, no.
Now I'm talking about allowing Maryland residents to be able to take advantage of DC airstrikes if they were on the feeder lines, or was that something that was done on the county level?
I don't think that was done in the Maryland level at all, and I'd have to check on that to be sure. But
Okay. Well, I know that it is happening. Yeah, I know that it's happening because I was unaware of this because I've been an advocate for renewable energy in an organization called Neighborhoods United. That they also operate in advocacy group. Operates in the state of Maryland. They have chapters, and they have and the director of the community engagement was educating me about this, because I was unaware of this because I happened to sit right on the line. But the system is about two blocks away from me, so I could not, even if I put a PV system on my roof, I wouldn't be able to take advantage of that. But I do know that this is something that people are doing who are aware of it. Now, I have another question for you, Mr. Linden. The Maryland Clean Energy Center, it has been given a unique position to develop a renewable energy policy in the state of Maryland. But what role does the Public Service Commission play in working with them in helping to design this kind of policy, or is there any connection?
Well, the Maryland Clean Energy Center puts together, they try to advance all of the different clean energy service products in the state. They work in conjunction with the Maryland Energy Administration, Department of Natural Resources, and other state agencies to develop those policies. They certainly don't do it on their own, but they do have a statutory responsibility to move forward with that effort. The commission plays a role as well. We participate in their initiatives and to the extent that they have conferences and opportunities to discuss and share ideas back and forth, we do that. The commission has its own statutory responsibilities from an oversight perspective. And so sometimes in the development of policy, we're not as engaged as other state agencies will be, because we have a statutory obligation to look at it on behalf of all ratepayers and to make sure that there is still a balance between the money spent that the utilities spend and the final bill that has to go to the customer. So we are engaged, but I'll say that we're not as engaged as every other party may be, because there's a certain distance we have to keep for some situations.
Well, that's quite understandable. Now, I got my one last question, because I know you got to go. I've held you more over the time that I ask this. Always when I have a very, very interesting guest such as you, Mr. Linden, that brings some very invaluable information to our community, because this discussion about the Public Service Commission with the immense amount of oversight and impact that it has as we're looking at workforce diversity and workforce development, all this thing. But one thing is very, very disturbing to me is that I have been reaching out to Morgan. I've reached out because I'm a Morgan alumnus. I've reached out to Morgan, their Department of Career Development. I reached out to Bowie State. I reached out to Coffin. I reached out to UMES. And I asked those offices, has companies that are solar and wind, renewable energy companies doing business in the state of Maryland, come to you recruiting any of our African-American students on the campus? And all of them said no. Now, you can go right to Indeed, put keywords, solar energy, wind energy, put your zip code in, and all of those job opportunities in this DMV market area. I actually do. Will be doing a segment today, and I do it every week on career opportunities in the DMV market area, and most of these opportunities in the state of Maryland. But when you go to these websites of these companies and you click on About Us and begin to look at their staffing and begin to look at all these positions, you see very, very few people of African and African-American descent working with these companies. And I have a problem with this. If you're going to come into the marketplace, because we all contribute to that as residents, as homeowners, through our property taxes and everything, to enable these companies to be able to come in and operate, but our young people are not getting these opportunities. So I know that you can't necessarily legislate anybody into hiring anybody, but if you want to come in and do a certain amount of business, then it seems to be should be some kind of way that these companies would have to have a certain percentage of jobs or opportunities for people from those communities.
Well, I can agree with you on that. I mean, one of the benefits that has been touted about the development of the solar industry in this country is that these are non-sourceable jobs. These are jobs that can't be transferred to another place. So, you know, you're not sending solar installer jobs to Asia or to Europe or anywhere else. These are people that have to be employees and citizens of this area because the work is right here. So there should absolutely be an effort, and I would hope that these companies are interested and are willing to work with these and hire people who live in these communities where they like to build their solar work, to do their solar work. And along those same lines, we need to make sure that that African Americans or Black people are ready to do that work when those jobs come calling.
I agree wholeheartedly. I had Mr. Eli Allen of Civic Works, who runs a pilot program, on my show last week talking about the pilot program he has in Baltimore City. And I'm scheduled to have Mrs. Cherie Brooks, who is the founder of the Power 252 Foundation that has a workforce development program in Ellicott City, and they're doing workforce development training. They're both grantees with the state, but in looking at the amount of money that's being spent, I mean, it's nowhere near what is needed for workforce development. So I've approached all of our HBCUs in the state talking to them about engaging during the summer months and working with the North American Board of Electric Practitioners and those two companies to look at implementing workforce development training programs that can be implemented with their oversight for these organizations, because they already have the experience and they have boots on the ground doing this. And as Mr. Allen explained to me last week, when you're working with young people, you got to meet them where they are. He said the first thing we deal with returning citizens, we got to make sure they got a driver's license. We help them with a $1,000 a grant so they can purchase an automobile, because most of these positions are not in the city of Baltimore. They got to be out in the counties. They got to deal with child support issues, and so they have to bring in legal aid services. And you would not think when someone's trying to train somebody in the classroom and with hands-on, or if you're doing rooftop PV or training an energy installer, you got to look at that entire aspect of what it's going to take to get that person to that job in the morning. But it's a holistic approach that they have in their model, which to me I find very, very exciting. for our residents. But the bottom line, if people don't know that these programs are out there, they can't take advantage of them. And there's little or no funding out here, because I've been beating the drum. I've been producing this show for 3 years over Blog Talk Radio, streaming over Facebook, Twitter. But it's like throwing a pebble in a Pacific Atlantic Ocean. If people don't know you're there, you don't exist. So the bottom line with this thing is there's got to be a way for me to raise the necessary dollars so I can go to the Coppins and the Bowies and the Morgans of this year, WEAAs of this world, and say, okay, Leah, I brought the money with me to pay for the programming, because we've got to get this information out. This information that you have shared with our listening audience, sir, is invaluable. And I want to thank you very, very much for taking time from your very, very busy schedule to join us on Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And is there anything that you would like to share with our listening audience in closing? Because I've kept you 30 minutes past the time that I asked you for. So,
well, Ron, I appreciate the opportunity. It was good to meet you at the Clean Energy Summit. And I'm thankful for the opportunity to speak with your guests. And with all your viewers, your listeners, your viewers will be in the future as their show grows in popularity, which I know it will. You know, the issues you're talking about are important, and they're becoming more and more important for everyone who's listening to your show, and even those folks who aren't. So I encourage you to keep up the good work, keep up the good fight, and anytime you need me to come on board and listen some more, if you want to go out to some of these HBCUs and we can talk to them more about how to start preparing our young folks to be ready for this new industries that are developing, you just let me know.
Well, Mr. Linton, I will definitely take you up on that, because, like I said, our people don't understand. I tell everybody the same thing. I said, look, everything starts with energy and everything ends with energy. And they really don't know what my organization does. Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative is an LLC. We incorporated in the state of Maryland. And what we were designed for was to try to get our historically Black colleges and universities, our HBCUs, to build large-scale power plants to offset their energy and to educate the Black community about the economic impacts of environment, climate change. And there's not a lot of discussion but around these issues, but we can't just deal with discussing this and quote statistics about how we've been disproportionately affected by this. Everybody knows that. The fact of the matter, what's the solution to it? The solution to this thing is getting our young people in our high schools, our junior colleges, and our colleges with these certification licenses that they need, and all this stuff is offered on board through the North American Board of Electric Practitioners, and these courses all through Kaplan University out of El Paso, Texas, online. Is in the university happened to be owned by the Washington Post, even though it's located in Texas. They've been doing this for years. We've got to get our young, get our schools plugged in. We've got to get our legislators who are making determination on how this workforce development money is doing. We've got to get more money funded to the civic works and the Foundation 52s of this world, and we got to plug them into our HBCUs and our community colleges for these workforce programs to take place during the summer months while these campuses are shut down and those buildings are not being used. Because it makes no sense to me for these many opportunities to be out here, and our young people walk across these stages with these degrees, but because they don't have a specific, if you got a certification as an electrician, as a plumber, HVAC, TV installer, energy in order, you don't have to go looking for jobs. People be looking for you. And right. To me, that's a travesty. And I want to thank you once again, Mr. Linton, for taking time from your very, very, very busy schedule to be a guest on Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you was listening to Mr. Linton, who is a true trailblazer in his own time and with the work that he does from day to day. And see, this is the importance of this show, to talk about our people who are working in these capacities with public service commissioners around this country. Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, we don't have a hell of a lot. We don't. And if you don't, hit the correct market niches and the locations in your geographical locations around this country, you're not going to find a lot of African American Public Service Commission serving on these commissions. Period. These are realities that are realities. So we need to encourage our young people to look at these type of professions, because we need them there. But we're going to take another pause for the calls here on Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America, and we'll be right back with news that I know that you can definitely use on another exciting edition of Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America.
Life is a song worth singing.
I can choose.
Sing it. Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.
I got you.
Sing it. Song worth singing.
I got you.
Sing it. Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.
Welcome back to the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. You know, those who listen to us on a regular basis, you know that this show is brought to you every week by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, which is a blueprint for economic self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American solar installation companies, to address the effects of high energy costs that are historic to Black colleges and universities, and to utilize Black-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects to bring down the under and unemployment of young African-Americans locally and nationally, also to educate the Black community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education in the Black community through radio programs such as Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. It's also brought to you every week by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSHBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative. And you'll be able to get more information by logging on to our website. And we are working once again to get our GoFundMe link back up, ladies and gentlemen. That campaign, if you don't put any money in it, it shuts down. That's the bottom line. So the bottom line, we're going to reinstate it for a third time and try to keep it going because we definitely need your support. Okay, it's also brought to you by ScottonCommunicationsNetwork.com, specializing in the following areas: public relations, writing, editing, web development, web editing, magazine production online and traditional, newspaper production online and traditional, speech writing, book writing, editing and publishing, and speaker bureau management. And for contact information, that's ScottonCommunicationsNetwork.com. Once again, that's ScottonCommunicationsNetwork.com. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as I've indicated, we're getting ready to switch gears here on Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. But we want to look at what has just recently taken place. The market area, wholesale market area, which Maryland is a part of, it is composed of, about 12 states. It's called the PJM region. Well, this area has tapped former Texas utility natural gas provider executive as their new CEO. And this was an article done by Mr. Luliagheorghiu is the author. Once again, that spelling is Luliagheorghiu. I don't like to chop up the pronunciation of individuals' names because they're from other countries, but believe me, I'm not going to struggle with it today, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to spell it out to you, and you can make it out. This article was published on yesterday, November 19th, in the online outstanding energy online magazine of Utility Dive, and it talked about JM Interconnection Board Managers have appointed Manu Austin Astana, as its new president and CEO, effective January 1, 2020. The grid operator announced on Monday. Most recently, Astana has served as the president of the Direct Energy Home, combining direct energy, retail, electricity, and home services businesses in North America. The electric and natural gas provider serves over 3.4 million customers. The grid operator has a lot on its plate in the near term, from applying for federal regulatory orders to allow energy storage to compete in the market to progressing with its delayed capacity auctions. Now, Astana will be the first PJM CEO to bring a competitive retail electric focus to the job. Electric industry is rapidly changing, and the PJM needs to continue to evolve, Ak Agerman, chairman of the PJM Board of Managers, said in his statement. Astana will lead the PJM into the future. Phil Harris and most recently CEO Andy Ault were both appointed from within the PJM, and Terry Boston led the transmission and power operations sector of the Tennessee Valley Authority before serving as the PJM CEO. Decisions come after a series of changes in PJM's leadership. The summer, PJM announced a 5 executive appointments focused on system reliability, competitive wholesale electric markets, and infrastructure planning. Art stepped down this summer. Sue Riley, the interim president and CEO, since Art's departure, will return to her position on the PJM's board of managers as Tennis takes over. Van U comes from two PJM with a wealth of experience from the electric value chain, which we are confident that he will bring a new and important perspective on the organizations. Augerman said, as Stannard declined interview requests before starting the job, but according to Link profile, he serves as the president of the Direct Energy Home in North America for more than 3 years until December of 2018. He was at Direct Energy for a total of 8 years and the TXU Energy other retail electricity provider in Texas for 12 years, where he his roles including trading and measuring assets as well as chief risk officer. So you got some a new player in the game who will be making decisions that will impact on the gas, water, and electric bill near you. It comes to you by way of the post office. Okay? So make no mistake about this, ladies and gentlemen. We are talking pocketbook issues. We have no clue, no idea who these people are. Put this information out there for you to be able to do your own research, because you can simply log on to our website at Positive Change, P as in Paul, C as in cat.com, and you can scroll down and you'll see this article. You can click on it, and there are links, and you can look up who this gentleman is, find out about his bio, and it'll give you some kind of indication on where things might be moving as it relates to your rates going up or down. It's the bottom line. But as I say, we always try to bring you every week news that you can definitely use here on this platform, Solar Now, and the future with its economic impact on Black America. Now, as we look at what's going on in this renewable energy sector, there's always something else jumping off. But as we promise, we try to do what we say we're going to do. And we're going to do that just right now, because we're going to talk about renewable energy opportunities here in the DMV market area, because these jobs, they're here every day. And all you got to do is to go to your browser, type in indeed.com, type in solar energy in the what title box keywords or company, put your zip code in, and these positions will pop up. Now, you will have to be able to, some of them requires what they require, but most of them provide training. So let's look at what we have on tap today. You have solar energy consultant with Solinka Inc., which is located in Atlanta, Maryland. The spelling of the company is S-O-L-I-L Inc. They're located in Atlanta, Maryland. This is a solar energy consultant position. Consultant will strive to exceed customers' expectations and build a strong relationship with the homeowner and business owners, focused on customer service. Now, this will be a sales representative position with them. You have direct sales consultant, also positioned with Trinity Solar. They are located in Hanover, Maryland. Now, ladies and gentlemen, everybody's projecting six figures if you work for them. This first position has earning potential of $100,000 to $150,000 a year. The position with direct sales consultants, they're talking $250K a year. That's a lot of cheese. Okay, when we begin to look at this issue, but you do need some form of training to get out here. Solar Sales Consultants, Commercial and Agriculture with Paradise Energy Solutions, Ellicott City, Maryland. They're projecting $80,000 to $150,000 a year. This is a sales position. Residential Solar Sales Consultant, Luna Manier Solar, L-U-M-I-N-A Solar, and it's in Helltop, Maryland. And they're looking for a sales director. Solar Sales Manager for Drones OME Services. That's with the Whitman Group Executive Search and Recruitment in Washington, D.C. Now, they're talking about 60 to 70 a year, okay? They need a sales manager, all right? Then you're looking at the public affairs intern with public affairs intern for Solar Energy Industries Association of Washington, D.C. This is a position that is available. Then you have inside sales associate, Enlight Energy, Beltsville, Maryland. They're looking for a sales representative. Energy Advisors, Energy and Security Group, Washington, D.C. Successful candidates will have 9 years of experience with the PJN or the Southeast Asian Australian region to speak fluent English. Okay, this is a position with Energy and Security Group of Washington, D.C. Regulatory Innovation Research Intern with Smart Energy Power Alliance in Washington, D.C. Solar Class Installation Trainer, Tesla, Beltsville, Maryland. A roofer is needed with VININT Solar in Beltsville, Maryland. They're looking for a roofer. Solar PV Engineer with RINA, RINA, in Washington, D.C. They're looking for Branch Manager Assistance, Alternative Energy Inc., Upper Marlboro. They need a branch manager, 45 to 60K a year. Sustainable Energy Finance Graduate Fellowship, Sustainable Capital Advisors in Washington, D.C. Solar Design Engineer, Entry Level, SG Power, Elkridge, Maryland. Residential Solar Sales Representative, SIGORA Solar, Falls Church, Virginia. Solar Sales Professional and Commercial and Agriculture Markets, that's Paradise Solar Energy Solutions. This is just in the district. We have 8 pages, ladies and gentlemen, of this information. As I've indicated on this show time and time again, this makes no sense to me that we cannot get these workforce development training programs implemented at our historically black colleges, working in conjunction with some of our African-American companies that do just that, workforce development companies. And if they got an excellent training program and they're willing to work in the hood, I really don't care what color they are at this point in time. Because we need more folks who are doing it rather than talking it. So we hope we brought to you news that you can definitely use. Until next week, ladies and gentlemen, we are saying to you once again here on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. You can go to our website at www.positivechangepc. You'll be able to hear today's show. You will be able to click on our news and events tab and take advantage of our blog with over 1,000 articles downloaded over the last 3 years that we developed this substantial online library for your educational use. So you need to go there and use it And while you're there, you need to click on the GoFundMe link and deal with that. So we hope we brought news that you can definitely use. And until next week, we say go in peace.
Life is a song worth singing. Sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing. I got you. Sing it.